Do you believe in zombies? Jones asked.
I don't know.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Let's not talk about ghosts, old man. Let's have another whiskey.
I thought I heard a movement and switched on the torch. It shone the whole length of a street of graves into a cat's eyes, which reflected like Franco studs. It leapt upon a roof and was gone.
Ought we to show a light, old man?
If there was anyone about to see it, he would be too scared to come. You couldn't do better than to dig in here tomorrow. It was not a happily chosen phrase to use in a cemetery.
I doubt if anyone comes here except to bury the dead.
Jones sucked in more whiskey, and I warned him, "There's only a quarter of a bottle left. You've got all tomorrow before you."
"Martha filled the shaker for me," he said. "I've never known a girl so thoughtful."
"Or such a good lay?" I asked.
There was a spell of silence. I thought perhaps he was remembering with pleasure the occasions. Then Jones said,
"Old man, the game's turned serious now."
"What game?"
"Playing at soldiers. I can understand why people want to confess. Death's a bloody serious affair. A man doesn't feel quite worthy of it, like a decoration."
"Have you such a lot to confess?"
"We all have. I don't mean to a priest or God."
"To whom?"
"To anyone at all. If I had a dog here tonight instead of you, I'd confess to the dog."
I didn't want his confessions. I didn't want to hear how many times he had slept with Martha. I said,
"Did you confess to Midge?"
"There wasn't any occasion. The game hadn't turned serious then."
"A dog, at least, has to keep your secrets."
"I don't care a damn who tells what, but I don't fancy a lot of lies after I'm dead. I've lied enough before."
I heard the cat come scrambling back over the roofs, and again I turned on my torch and lit the eyes. This time it flattened itself upon a stone and began to scrape its nails. Jones opened his kit bag and pulled out a sandwich. He broke it in half and tossed one half towards the cat, which flared as though the bread were a stone.
"You'd better be careful," I said. "You're on short rations now."
"The poor devil's hungry." He put the half-sandwich back, and we and the cat were silent a long while. It was Jones who broke the silence with his obstinate obsession.
"I'm an awful liar, old man."
"I've always assumed that," I said.
"What I said about Martha, there wasn't a word of truth in it. She's only one of 50 women I haven't had the courage to touch."
I wondered if he was telling the truth now, or graduating to a more honourable sort of lie. Perhaps he had detected something in my manner which told him all. Perhaps he pitied me. One could hardly sink lower, I thought, than that, to be pitied by Jones. He said,
"I've always lied about women." He gave an uneasy laugh. "The moment I had Tintin, she became a leading member of the Haitian aristocracy. If there had been anyone around to tell about it. Do you know, old man, I haven't had a single woman in my life I haven't paid, or at least promised to pay. Sometimes I've had to welch when things were bad."
"Martha told me she'd slept with you."
"She can't have told you that. I don't believe you."
"Oh, yes, it was almost the last word she said to me."
"I never realized," he said gloomily.
"Realized what?"
"That she was your girl. Another of my lies has found me out. You mustn't believe her. She was angry because you were going away with me."
"Or angry because I was taking you away." There was a scrabble in the dark where the cat had found the bit of sandwich. I said,
"There's quite a jungle atmosphere here. You'll feel at home."
I heard him take a pull at the whiskey, and then he said, "Old man, I've never been in a jungle in my life, unless you count the Calcutta Zoo."
"Were you never in Burma?"
"Oh, yes, I was, or nearly. Anyway, I was only 50 miles from the border.
I was at Imphal in charge of entertaining the troops. Well, not exactly in charge. We had Noel Coward once, he added with pride and a sense of relief. It was something true that he could boast about. How did the two of you get on?
I didn't actually speak to him, Jones said.
But you were in the army?
No, I was rejected, flat feet. They found I'd managed a cinema in Shillong, so they gave me this job. I had a uniform of a kind, but without badges or rank. I was in liaison, he added, with that note of odd pride, with Ensa.
I flashed my torch around the acre of grey tombs. I said, "Why the hell are we here, then?"
I boasted a bit too much, didn't I?
You've let yourself into a nasty situation. Aren't you frightened?
I'm like a fireman at his first fire, he said.
Your flat feet won't enjoy these mountain tracks.
I can manage with supports, Jones said. You won't tell them, old man?
It was a confession.
They'll soon find out without my telling them. So you can't even use a Bren?
They haven't got a Bren.
You've spoken too late. I can't smuggle you back.
I don't want to go back. Old man, you don't know what it was like in Imphal. I used to make friends sometimes. I could introduce them to girls, and then they'd go away and never come back. Or they'd come back once or twice for a yarn. There was a man called Charters who could smell water. He broke off abruptly, remembering.
Another lie? I said, as though I myself were a man of scrupulous rectitude.
Not exactly a lie, he said. You see, when he told me that, it was like someone calling me by my real name.
Which wasn't Jones?
Jones was on my birth certificate, he said. I've seen it there myself, and brushed the question aside. When he told me that, I knew I could do the same with a bit of practice. I knew I had it in me. I made my clerk hide glasses of water in the office, and then I'd wait till I had a big thirst and sniff. It didn't work very often, but then tap water is not the same, he added. I think I'll ease my feet a bit, and I could tell from his movements that he was pulling off his gumboots.
How did you come to be in Shillong? I asked.
I was born in Assam. My father planted tea, or so my mother said.
You had to take it on trust?
Well, he went home before I was born.
Your mother was Indian?
Half Indian, old man, he said, as though he attributed importance to fractions. It was like meeting an unknown brother. Jones and Brown, the names were almost interchangeable, and so was our status. For all we knew, we were both bastards, although, of course, there might have been a ceremony. My mother had always given me that impression. We had both been thrown into the water to sink or swim, and swim we did. We had swum from very far apart to come together in a cemetery in Haiti.
I like you, Jones, I said. If you don't want that half a sandwich, I could do with it.
Of course, old man. He fingered in his kit bag and felt for my hand in the dark.
Tell me more, Jones, I said.
I came to Europe, he said, after the war. I got into a lot of scrapes. Somehow I couldn't find what I was intended to do. You know, there had been times in Imphal when I almost wished the Japs would reach us. The authorities would have armed even the camp followers then, like me and the clerks in Naffy and the cooks. After all, I had a uniform. A lot of unprofessionals do well in war, don't they? I've learnt a lot, listening, studying maps, watching. You can feel a vocation, can't you, even if you can't practice it? And there I was, checking transport and travel vouchers for third-class entertainers. Mr. Coward was one of the exceptions, and I had to keep an eye on the girls. I called them girls, old troopers more like. My office smelt like a stage dressing room.
The grease paint drowned the smell of water, I said.
You were right, it wasn't a fair test.
I only wanted my chance, he added, and I wondered whether perhaps in all his devious life he had been engaged on a secret and hopeless love affair with Virtue, watching Virtue from a distance, hoping to be noticed, perhaps, like a child doing wrong, in order to attract the attention of Virtue. And now you have the chance, I said. Thanks to you, old man. I thought that what you wanted most was a golf club. That's true, it was my second dream. You have to have two, don't you, in case the first goes wrong? Yes, I suppose so. Making money had been my dream also. Had there been another? I had no wish to search so far back. You'd better try to sleep a while, I said. It won't be safe to sleep in daylight. And sleep he did, almost at once, curled up like an embryo below the tomb. That was one quality he shared with Napoleon, and I wondered whether perhaps there might be others. Once he opened his eyes and remarked that this was a good place, and then slept again. I could see nothing good in it, but in the end I slept as well. After a couple of hours, something woke me. I imagined for a moment it was the noise of a car, but I thought it unlikely that a car would be out on the road so early, and the wreck of a dream stayed with me and accounted for the noise. I had been driving my car across a river on a bed of boulders. I lay still and listened, with my eyes watching the grey early sky. I could see the shapes of the tombs standing around. Soon the sun would be up. It was time to get back to the car. When I was sure of the silence, I woke Jones. "You'd better not sleep again now," I said. "I'll walk a little way with you." "Oh, no, you won't, for my sake. You must keep away from the road until it's dark. The peasants will be going to market soon. They'll report any white man they see." "Then they'll report you." "I have my alibi, a smashed car on the road to Lake A. You'll have to keep company with the cat till dark. Then go to the hut and wait for Filippo." Jones insisted on shaking hands. In the reasonable light of day, the affection which I had felt for him was leaking rapidly away. I thought again of Martha, and as though he were half aware of my thoughts, he said, "Give my love to Martha when you see her. Luis and Angel too, of course." "And Midge?" "It was good," he said. "It was like being in a family." I walked down a long street of graves towards the road. I was not born for the Marquis. I took no precautions. I thought, Martha had no reason to lie, or had she? Opposite the wall of the cemetery stood a jeep, but the sight of it for a moment didn't change the current of my thoughts. Then I stopped and stood waiting. It was too dark yet to see who was at the wheel, but I knew very well what was going to happen next. The voice of Concasseur whispered, "Stay just there. Quite still. Don't move." He got out of the jeep, followed by the fat chauffeur with the gold teeth. Even in the half-light he wore the black spectacles which were his only uniform. A tommy gun of ancient make was pointed at my chest. "Where is Major Jones?" Concasseur whispered. "Jones?" I said as loudly as I dared. "How would I know? My car broke down. I have a pass to Lake A, as you know." "Speak quietly. I am taking you and Major Jones back to Port-au-Prince, alive, I hope. The President would prefer that. I have to make my peace with the President." "You're being absurd. You must have seen my car by the road. I was on the way." "Oh, yes, I saw it. I was expecting to see it." The tommy gun twisted in his hands and pointed away somewhere to my left. There was no advantage to me in that. The chauffeur had his gun covering me, too. "Come forward," Concasseur said. I made a step forward, and he said, "Not you, Major Jones." I turned and saw Jones was standing there behind me. He held what was left of the whiskey in his hand. I said, "You bloody fool, why didn't you stay put?" "I'm sorry. I thought perhaps you might need the whiskey waiting." "Get into the jeep," Concasseur said to me. I obeyed. He went up to Jones and struck him in the face. "You cheat," he said. "There was enough in it for both of us," Jones said, and Concassaire hit him again. The chauffeur stood and watched. There was enough light to see the wink of his gold teeth as he grinned.
"Get in beside your friend," Concassaire said.
While the chauffeur held us covered, he turned and began to walk towards the jeep. A noise, if it is loud and close enough, almost escapes the hearing. I felt a vibration in my eardrums rather than heard the explosion. I saw Concassaire knocked backwards as though struck by an invisible fist. The chauffeur pitched upon his face. A scrap of the cemetery wall leapt in the air and dropped, a long time afterwards, with a small ping in the road. Filippo came out of the hut, and Joseph limped after him. They carried Tommy guns of the same ancient make. Concassaire's black glasses lay in the road. Filippo ground them to pieces under his heel, and the body showed no resentment. Filippo said, "I left the driver for Joseph."
Joseph was bending down over the driver and working on his teeth.
"We've got to move quickly," Filippo said. "They'll have heard the shots in our camp. Where is Major Jones?"
Joseph said, "He went into the cemetery."
"He must be fetching his kit bag," I said. "Tell him to hurry."
I walked up between the little grey houses to the spot where we had passed the night. Jones was there, kneeling beside the tomb in the attitude of prayer, but the face he turned to me was olive green with sickness. He had vomited on the ground. He said,
"I'm sorry, old man, one of those things. Please don't tell them, but I've never seen a man die before."
Chapter 4-1 I drove along many kilometres of wire fencing to find a gate. Mr. Fernandez had procured for me in Santo Domingo a small sports car at a cut rate, perhaps a too flippant car for my errand, and I had a personal introduction from Mr. Smith. I had left Santo Domingo in the afternoon, and now it was sunset. There were no roadblocks in those days in the Dominican Republic, and all was peace. There was no military junta, and the American Marines had not yet landed. For half the distance I followed a wide highway where cars went by me at 100 miles an hour. The sense of peace was very real after the violence of Haiti, which seemed more than a few 100 kilometres away. Nobody stopped me to examine my papers. I came to a gate in the fence, which was locked. A negro in a steel helmet and blue dungarees asked my business from the other side of the wire. I told him I had come to see Mr. Schuyler Wilson.
"Let me see your pass," he demanded, and I felt as though I were back where I had come from.
"He expects me." The negro went to a hut, and I saw him telephoning. I had almost forgotten that telephones worked. Then he opened the gate and gave me a badge, which he said I was to wear so long as I was on the mining estate. I could drive as far as the next barrier. I drove a good many miles beside the flat blue Caribbean Sea. I passed a small landing ground with a wind stocking blowing towards Haiti, and then a harbour empty of boats. The red bauxite dust lay everywhere. I came to another barrier closing the road, and another negro in a tin hat. He examined my badge and took my name again, and my business, and telephoned. Then he told me to wait where I was. Someone would come for me. I waited 10 minutes.
"Is this the Pentagon?" I asked him, "or the headquarters of the CIA?"
He wouldn't speak to me. He probably had orders not to speak. I was glad he didn't carry a gun. Then a motorcycle arrived, driven by a white man in a tin helmet. He spoke practically no English, and I knew no Spanish. He indicated I was to follow his motorcycle. We drove on for a few kilometres more of red earth and blue sea before we reached the first administrative buildings, rectangular blocks of cement and glass with no one in sight. Further on was a luxurious trailer park where children played with space uniforms and space guns. Women looked out of windows over kitchen stoves, and there was a smell of cooking.
At last, before a great glass building, we came to a halt. There was a flight of steps wide enough for a parliament and a terrace with lounging chairs. A large fat man with an anonymous face shaved as smooth as marble stood at the top. He might have been a city mayor waiting to deliver a freedom.
"Mr. Brown?
Mr. Schuyler Wilson?" He looked at me in a surly way. Perhaps I had pronounced his first name wrong. Perhaps he disliked my sports car. He said grudgingly, "Have a Coke," and gestured towards one of the lounging chairs. "If you could spare a whiskey," he said without enthusiasm, "I'll see what we can do," and walked into the great glass building, leaving me alone. I felt I had chalked up a black mark. Perhaps only visiting directors or leading politicians got whiskey. I was only a potential catering manager seeking a job. However, he brought the whiskey, carrying a Coke in his other hand like a reproach. "Mr. Smith wrote to you about me," I said. I just stopped myself from saying the presidential candidate.
"Yes, where did you two meet?"
"He stayed at my hotel in Port-au-Prince."
"That's right."
It was as though he were double-checking the facts to see if one of us had lied.
"You're not a vegetarian?"
"No."
"Because the boys here like their steak and French fries."
I drank a little of the whiskey, which was drowned in soda. Mr. Schuyler Wilson watched me closely, as though he begrudged me every drop. I felt more and more that the job would not come my way.
"What's your experience in catering?"
"Well, I owned this hotel in Haiti until a month ago. I've worked too at the Trocadero in London, and I added the ancient lie, Fouquet's in Paris."
"Got any testimonials?"
"I could hardly write my own, could I? I've been my own employer a good many years now."
"Your Mr. Smith's a bit of a crank, isn't he?"
"I like him."
"Did his wife tell you he ran for president once, on the vegetarian ticket?"
Mr. Schuyler Wilson laughed. It was an angry laugh without amusement, like the menace of a hidden beast.
"I suppose it was a form of propaganda." "I don't like propaganda. We've had leaflets here pushed under the wire, trying to get at the men. We pay them well, we feed them well. What made you leave Haiti?"
"Trouble with the authorities. I helped an Englishman to escape from Port-au-Prince. The Tonton Macoot were after him."
"What's the Tonton Macoot?"
"We were less than 300 kilometers from Port-au-Prince. It seems strange he could ask me that, but I suppose there hadn't been a story for a long time in any newspaper he read."
"The secret police," I said. "How did you get out?"
"His friends helped me across the border." It was a brief enough statement to cover 2 weeks of fatigue and frustration.
"Who do you mean, his friends?"
"The insurgents."
"You mean the communists?"
He was cross-examining me as though I had applied for a job as agent in the CIA and not as a catering manager for a mining company. I lost my temper a little. I said,
"Insurgents are not always communists until you make them so."
My irritation amused Mr. Schuyler Wilson. He smiled for the first time. It was a smile of self-satisfaction, as though he had uncovered, by adroit questioning, something I had wanted to keep secret.
"You're quite an expert," he said.
"An expert?"
"I mean owning your own hotel, working at that place you mentioned in Paris. I guess you wouldn't be very happy here. Just plain American cooking is all we need."
He got up to show me that the interview was over. I finished my whiskey while he watched me with impatience, and then,
"Glad to have met you," he said, without shaking hands. "Give up your badge at the second gate."
I drove away past the private landing ground and the private port. I handed over my badge. I was reminded of the entry permit you leave with immigration at Idlewild. 2. I drove to the Ambassador Hotel on the outskirts of Santo Domingo, where Mr. Smith was staying. It wasn't the right setting for him, or so it seemed to me. I had become accustomed to the stooping figure, the mild and modest face, and the wild white hair in surroundings of poverty. In this wide, glittering hall, men sat wearing purses on their belts instead of revolver holsters, and when they wore dark glasses, it was only to save their eyes from the bright light. There was a continuous rattle from the one-armed bandits, and you could hear the calls from the croupier in the casino. Everyone had money here, even Mr. Smith. Poverty was out of sight, down in the city. A girl in a bikini wearing a gay bathrobe came in from the swimming pool. She asked at the desk whether a Mr. Hochstrudel Jr. had arrived yet. "I mean Mr. Wilbur K. Hochstrudel." The clerk said, "No, but Mr. Hochstrudel is expected." I sent a message to Mr. Smith that I was below and found myself a seat. At the table nearest me, the men were drinking rum punches, and I thought of Joseph's. He made better ones than they served here, and I missed him. I had stayed only 24 hours with Filippo. He was polite enough to me in a restrained way, but he was a changed man from the one I used to know. I had been a good audience in the past for his Baudelairean verses, but I was too old for war. It was Jones he needed now, and Jones's company which he sought. He had 9 men with him in his hideout, and to hear him talking to Jones, you would have imagined he commanded at least a battalion. Jones very wisely listened and didn't speak much, but once I woke, during the night I spent with them, and heard Jones say, "You have to establish yourself near enough to the frontier for newspaper men to come over. Then you can demand recognition." Were they really in this hole among the rocks, and they changed their hole, I learned each day, already thinking in terms of a provisional government? They had with them 3 old Tommy guns from the police station, which had probably seen service first in the days of Al Capone, a couple of First War rifles, a shotgun, 2 revolvers, and one man had nothing better than his machete. Jones added, like an old hand, "This kind of war is a bit like a confidence trick. There was one way we deceived the Japs." He hadn't found his golf course, but I really believe he was happy. The men clustered close. They couldn't understand a word he said, but it was as though a leader had come into the camp. Next day, I was sent off with Joseph as my guide to try to cross the Dominican frontier. My car and the bodies had been long discovered by now, and there was no safety for me anywhere in Haiti. They could spare Joseph easily because of his damaged hip, and he could fulfill at the same time a second function. Filippo planned that I was to slip over the international road, which divided the 2 republics, for about 50 kilometers north of Banica. It was true that every few kilometers on either side of the road there were Haitian and Dominican guard posts, but it was said, with what truth he wanted to find out, that the posts on the Haitian side were deserted at night for fear of a guerrilla attack. All peasants had been expelled from the border, but there was said to be still that party of about 30 men operating in the mountains with which Filippo wanted to make contact. Joseph's information would be of value if he got back, and he was more expendable than the others. I suppose, too, his lame walk was considered slow enough to enable a man of my age to keep up with him. The last words Jones said to me in private were, "I'm going to keep it up, old man."
"And the golf club?"
"The golf club's for old age, after we've taken Port-au-Prince." The journey was slow, rough, and tiring, and took us 11 days, 9 days of lying up, of sudden dashes from one point to another, of doubling on our tracks, and finally 2 last days of imprudence because of hunger. I was glad enough when we came in sight at dusk from our grey eroded mountain, where nothing grew, of the deep Dominican forest. You could see all the twists of the frontier by the contrast between our bare rocks and their vegetation. It was the same mountain range,
but the trees never crossed into the poor dry land of Haiti. Halfway down the slope was a Haitian guard post, a collection of decrepit huts, and across the way, 100 yards from it, was a castellated fort like something from the Spanish Sahara. A little before dusk we saw the Haitian guards straggle out, leaving not one sentinel behind. We watched them go to God knows what hideout. There were no roads or villages where they could escape the pitiless rock. Then I said goodbye to Joseph, making some silly joke about rum punch, and scrambled down the track of a meager stream onto the International Road, a grand name for a track little better than the Great Southern Highway to Lake Gay. Next morning the Dominicans put me on an army truck which came daily to the fort with supplies, and I landed in Santo Domingo in torn and dusty clothes, with 100 unchangeable gourds in my pocket and 50 American dollars comprised in a single note which I had sewn for safety into the lining of my pants. With the help of that note I took a room and a bath and cleaned myself up and slept for 12 hours before I went to beg for money at the British consulate and for expatriation to where? It was Mr. Smith who saved me from that humiliation. He happened to be driving by Mr. Fernandez's car, and he saw me on the street as I tried to ask my way to the consulate from a Negro who only spoke Spanish. I wanted Mr. Smith to drop me at the consulate, but he would have none of it. All such matters, he said, could wait till after lunch. And when lunch was over, he told me it was quite out of the question to borrow money from an unsympathetic consul, since he, Mr. Smith, was there with plenty of American Express dollars.
"Think what I owe you," he said. But I could think of nothing that he owed me. He had paid his bill at the Hotel Trianon. He had even supplied his own yeast roll. He appealed against me to Mr. Fernandez, and Mr. Fernandez said yes, and Mrs. Smith remarked angrily that if I thought her husband was the kind of man to let a friend down, then I should have been with them that day in Nashville. Waiting for him now, I thought what a continent of difference divided him from Mr. Schuyler Wilson. He was alone when he joined me in the lounge of the ambassador. He apologized for the absence of Mrs. Smith, who was taking her third lesson in Spanish from Mr. Fernandez.
"You should hear the two of them talking away together," he said. "Mrs. Smith has a remarkable talent for languages."
I told him how I had been received by Mr. Schuyler Wilson. "He assumed I was a communist," I said.
"Why?"
"Because the Tonton were after me. Papa Doc, you remember, is a bulwark against communism. And insurgent, of course, is a dirty word. I wonder how President Johnson would deal now with something like the French resistance. That, too, was infiltrated, another dirty word, by the communists. My mother was an insurgent. Lucky I didn't tell Mr. Schuyler Wilson that."
"I don't see what harm a communist could do as a catering manager." Mr. Smith looked at me with an expression of sadness. He said, "It's not at all pleasant to feel ashamed of a fellow countryman."
"You must have experienced it often enough in Nashville."
"That was different. There it was a disease, a fever. I could be sorry for them. In my state we still have a tradition of hospitality. When a man knocks on the door, we don't ask him about his politics."
"I hope to be able to pay you back your loan."
"I'm not a poor man, Mr. Brown. There's plenty more where that came from. I suggest you take another $1,000 now."
"How can I? I have no security to offer you."
"If that's what's worrying you, we'll draw up a paper, quite fair and legal, and I'll take a mortgage on your hotel. After all, it's a fine property."
"It's not worth a nickel now, Mr. Smith. The government has probably taken it over."
"Things will change one day."
"I've heard of another job in the north, near Monte Cristi, as canteen manager for a fruit company."
"You don't have to fall as low as that, Mr. Brown."
"I've fallen a lot lower than that in my time, and less respectably. If you don't mind my using your name again, this is an American company, too."
"Mr. Fernandez was telling me that he needs an Anglo-Saxon partner. It's a fine, prosperous little business he has here."
I've never thought of becoming an undertaker. It's a valuable social service, Mr. Brown, and there's security, too. No business recessions. I'll try the canteen first. I've more experience there. If that fails, who knows? Did you know Mrs. Pineda was in town? Mrs. Pineda? That charming lady who came up to the hotel. Surely you'll remember her. For a moment, I really hadn't known whom he meant. What's she doing in Santo Domingo? Her husband has been transferred to Lima. She's staying a few days here at her embassy with her little boy, I forget his name. Angel. That's right, a fine boy. Mrs. Smith and I are very fond of children, perhaps because we never had any of our own. Mrs. Pineda was glad to hear you'd come out of Haiti in one piece, but she was naturally anxious about Major Jones. I thought we might all have a little dinner together tomorrow night, and you could tell her the story. I'm planning to go north tomorrow early, I said. Jobs can't wait. I've been hanging around here long enough. Tell her I'll write to her all I know about Jones. 3. I had a jeep to withstand the road on this occasion, arranged for me again at a cut price by Mr. Fernandez. Nevertheless, I was not to reach Monte Cristi and the banana plantations, and I shall never know whether I would have proved acceptable as a canteen manager. I set off at 6 in the morning and reached San Juan by breakfast time. There was a good road as far as Alias Pinas, but then along the frontier, perhaps because there was no traffic except the daily bus and a few military camions, the international road was more suitable for mules and cows. I had reached the military post of Pedro Santana when I was stopped. I didn't understand why. The lieutenant, whom I knew by sight, because I had met him a month ago when I came over the frontier, was busy talking to a fat man in city clothes. He was being shown a lot of glittering junk jewelry, necklaces, bracelets, watches, rings. The frontier was a happy hunting ground for smugglers. Money changed hands, and the lieutenant came to my jeep. "What's wrong?" I asked. "Wrong? Nothing is wrong." He spoke French as well as I did. "Your men won't let me go on." "It's for your own safety. There's a lot of firing on the other side of the international road. Wild firing. I've seen you before, haven't I?"
"I came across the road a month ago."
"Yes, I remember now. I dare say we shall be seeing some more people like you presently."
"Do you often get refugees here?"
"We had about 20 guerrillas over just after you came. They are in a camp now in Santo Domingo. I thought there were none left." He must have meant the band which Filippo had wanted to contact. I remembered Jones and Filippo talking in the night, while the men listened, of the great plans for an established strong point, for a provisional government, for visiting journalists. "I want to get up to Monte Cristi before dark."
"You would do better to go back to Elias Pinas."
"No, I'll wait around, if you don't mind."
"You are welcome."
I had a bottle of whiskey in my car, and I made myself more welcome. The man selling jewelry tried to interest me in some earrings, which he said were sapphire and diamond. Presently he drove away in the direction of Elias Pinas. He had sold the lieutenant a watch and the sergeant 2 necklaces.
"For the same woman?" I asked the sergeant.
"For my wife," he said, and closed one eye. It was high noon. I sat on the steps of the guardroom in the shade and considered what I should do if the fruit company turned me down. There was always Mr. Fernandez's offer. I wondered whether I would have to wear a black suit. Perhaps there is an advantage in being born in a city like Monte Carlo, without roots, for one accepts more easily what comes. The rootless have experienced, like all the others, the temptation of sharing the security of a religious creed or a political faith, and for some reason we have turned the temptation down. We are the faithless. We admire the dedicated, the Dr. Maggios and the Mr. Smiths, for their courage and their integrity,
for their fidelity to a cause, but through timidity or through lack of sufficient zest, we find ourselves the only ones truly committed, committed to the whole world of evil and of good, to the wise and to the foolish, to the indifferent and to the mistaken. We have chosen nothing except to go on living, rolled round on earth's diurnal course with rocks and stones and trees. The argument interested me. I dare say it eased the never-quiet conscience which had been injected into me without my consent, when I was too young to know, by the fathers of the visitation. Then the sun came round onto the steps and drove me into the guardhouse, with its bunks like stretchers, its pin-ups and relics of many homes, its heavy, airless smell. There the lieutenant came to find me. He said, "You'll be able to go on soon now. They are coming in." Some Dominican soldiers were plodding up the road to the post, walking in single file so as to keep in the shade of the trees. They bore their rifles slung and carried in their hands the weapons of the men who had emerged from the Haitian hills and who walked a few paces behind them, limp with fatigue, wearing an abashed look on their faces, like the expression of children who have broken something of value. I didn't recognize any of the Negroes, but nearly at the tail of the little column I saw Filippo. He was naked to the waist, and he had used his shirt to tie his right arm to his side. When he saw me, he said defiantly, "We had no ammunition left." But I don't think he recognized me then. He saw only what he thought was an accusing white face. At the very end of the small column, two men carried a stretcher. On it lay Joseph. His eyes were open, but he couldn't see the foreign country into which they were carrying him. One of the men asked, "Do you know him?" "Yes," I said. "He used to make good rum punches." The two men looked at me with disapproval. I realized it was not the kind of speech one should make over the dead. Mr. Fernandez would have done better, and I followed after the stretcher in silence like a mourner. Somebody had given Filippo a chair inside the guardhouse and a cigarette. The lieutenant was explaining to him that they had no transport until next day, and that they had no doctor in the post. "It's only a broken arm," Filippo said. "I fell coming down the ravine. It's nothing at all. I can wait." The lieutenant said with kindness, "We have made a comfortable camp for your people near Santo Domingo, in an old lunatic asylum." Filippo began to laugh. "A lunatic asylum? You are right." And then to cry. He put his hands over his eyes to hide them. I said, "I have a car here. If the lieutenant permits, you needn't wait. Emile is wounded in the foot. We can take him with us." "I don't want to be separated from them now. Who are you?" "Oh, of course, I know you. My mind's confused." "The two of you need a doctor. There's no point in waiting here till tomorrow. Are you expecting anyone else to come across?" "I was thinking of Jones." "No, there's no one else." I tried to remember how many had come up the road. "All the rest are dead?" I asked. "All dead." I made the two men as comfortable as I could in the jeep, and the fugitives stood and watched with pieces of bread in their hands. There were six of them, and Joseph lying dead on a stretcher in the shade. They had the dazed look of men who have narrowly escaped from a forest fire. We drove away, two men waved, the others munched their bread. I said to Filippo, "And Jones, is he dead?"
"By this time."
"Was he wounded?"
"No, but his feet gave out."
I had to drag the information out of him. I thought at first that he wanted to forget, but he was just preoccupied. I said, "Was he all that you hoped?"
"He was a wonderful man. With him we began to learn, but he didn't have enough time. The men loved him. He made them laugh."
"But he spoke no Creole."
He did not need words. How many men are there in this lunatic asylum?
About 20.
All those you were looking for.
When we can get arms again, we will go back,
I said to comfort him.
Of course.
I would like to find his body. I would like him to have a proper grave. I'm going to put up a stone where we cross the frontier, and one day when Papa Doc is dead, we shall put a similar stone at the spot where he died. It will be a place of pilgrimage. I shall get the British ambassador, perhaps a member of the royal family.
I hope Papa Doc doesn't outlive us all. We turned out of Elias Pinas onto the good road for San Juan. I said,
so, after all, he proved that he could do it.
Do what?
Lead a commando.
He had proved that against the Japanese.
Yes, I had forgotten.
He was a cunning man. You know how he deceived Papa Doc?
Yes.
Do you know that he could smell water a long way off?
He really could?
Of course, but as it happened, water was not a thing we ever lacked.
Was he a good shot?
Our weapons were so old, so out of date, I had to teach him. He was not a good shot. He went through Burma with a walking stick, he told me, but he knew how to lead.
On his flat feet.
How did the end come? We came up to the border to find the others, and we were ambushed. It was not his fault. Two men were killed. Joseph was badly hurt. There was nothing to do but escape. We could not go fast because of Joseph. He died coming down the last ravine.
And Jones?
He could hardly move because of his feet. He found what he called a good place. He said he'd keep the soldiers off till we had time to reach the road. None of them was anxious to risk himself very close. He said he would follow slowly, but I knew he could never come.
Why?
He told me once that there was no room for him outside of Haiti.
I wonder what he meant.
He meant his heart was there.
I thought of the captain's cable from the office in Philadelphia and the message that the chargé had received. There was more in his past than a cocktail shaker stolen from Asprey's, that was certain.
Filippo said, I had grown to love him. I would like to write about him to the Queen of England.
4. They held a mass for Joseph and the other dead men. All three were Catholics, and Jones, whose beliefs were not known, was included out of courtesy. I went to the small Franciscan church in a side street with Mr. and Mrs. Smith. It was a tiny congregation. One felt surrounded by the indifference of the world outside Haiti. Filippo led in the small company from the lunatic asylum, and at the last moment Martha entered with Angel at her side. A Haitian refugee priest said the mass, and of course Mr. Fernandez was there. He looked professional and accustomed to such occasions. Angel behaved well, and he seemed to be thinner than I remembered him. I wondered why in the past I had found him so detestable, and I wondered, too, looking at Martha 2 paces in front, why our semi-attached life had been so important. It seemed to belong now exclusively to Port-au-Prince, to the darkness and the terror of the curfew, to the telephones that didn't work, to the tonton macoute in their dark glasses, to violence, injustice, and torture. Like some wines, our love could neither mature nor travel. The priest was a young man of Filippo's age, with the light skin of a Métis. He preached a very short sermon on some words of St. Thomas the Apostle. Let us go up to Jerusalem and die with him. He said, the church is in the world, it is part of the suffering in the world, and though Christ condemned the disciple who struck off the ear of the high priest's servant, our hearts go out in sympathy to all who are moved to violence by the suffering of others. The church condemns violence, but it condemns indifference more harshly.
Violence can be the expression of love, indifference never. One is an imperfection of charity, the other the perfection of egoism. In the days of fear, doubt, and confusion, the simplicity and loyalty of one apostle advocated a political solution. He was wrong, but I would rather be wrong with St. Thomas than right with the cold and the craven. Let us go up to Jerusalem and die with him. Mr. Smith shook his head sorrowfully. It was not a sermon which appealed to him. There was in it too much of the acidity of human passion. I watched Filippo go up to the altar rail to receive communion, followed by most of his little band. I wondered whether they had confessed their sins of violence to the priest. I doubted whether he had required of them a firm purpose of amendment. After Mass, I found myself standing beside Martha and the child. I noticed that Angel had been crying. "He loved Jones," Martha said. She took me by the hand and led me into a side chapel. We were alone with a hideous statue of St. Clair. She said, "I have bad news for you." "I know already. Luis has been transferred to Lima." "Is that really such bad news? We had reached an end, hadn't we, you and I?" "Had we? Jones is dead." "He mattered more to Angel than to me. You made me angry that last night. If it hadn't been Jones you worried about, it would have been someone else. You were looking for a way to finish. I never slept with Jones. You've got to believe that. I loved him, but in quite a different way." "Yes, I can believe you now." "But you wouldn't have believed me then." The fact that, after all, she had been faithful to me was ironic, but it seemed singularly unimportant now. I almost wished that Jones had had his fun. "What is your bad news?"
"Dr. Maggio is dead."
I never knew the day when my father died, if he had died, so that I experienced for the first time the sense of sudden separation from someone on whom, as a last resort, I could depend. "How did it happen?"
"The official version is that he was killed resisting arrest. They accused him of being an agent of Castro's, a communist."
"He was a communist, certainly, but I'm pretty sure he was no one's agent."
"The true story is that they sent a peasant to his door asking him to come and help a sick child. He came out onto the path, and the Tonton Macoute shot him down from a car. There were witnesses. They killed the peasant too, but that was probably not intended."
"It had to happen. Papa Doc is a bulwark against communism."
"Where are you staying?"
I told her the name of the small hotel in the city.
"Shall I come and see you?" she asked. "I can this afternoon. Angel has friends."
"If you really want to."
"I leave for Lima tomorrow."
"If I were you," I told her, "I know that I wouldn't come."
"Will you write and tell me how things go with you?"
"Of course." I sat in the hotel through the whole afternoon in case she came, but I was glad she stayed away. I remembered how twice before our lovemaking had been disturbed by the dead, first Marcel and then the ancien ministre. Now it was Dr. Maggio, who had joined the dignified and disciplined ranks. They rebuked our levity. In the evening I had dinner with the Smiths and Mr. Fernandez. Mrs. Smith acted as my interpreter. She had learnt enough Spanish for that, but Mr. Fernandez, too, was able to talk a little. It was agreed I should become a junior partner in the Fernandez business. I was to deal with the French and the Anglo-Saxon bereaved, and we were both promised an interest in Mr. Smith's vegetarian center when it was established. Mr. Smith thought it only fair, since our business might be adversely affected by the success of vegetarianism. Perhaps the center would really have been established if violence had not come in turn a few months later to Santo Domingo, violence which brought a measure of prosperity to Mr. Fernandez and myself, though as usual in such cases
The dead mainly belong to Mr. Fernandez's side of the business. Colored people get killed more easily than Anglo-Saxons. That night, when I went back to my hotel room, I found a letter on my pillow, a letter from the dead. I never learned who had brought it. The clerk could tell me nothing. The letter was not signed, but the writing was unmistakably Dr. Maggio's. "Dear friend," I read, "I write to you because I loved your mother, and in these last hours I want to communicate with her son. My hours are limited. I expect any moment that knock upon the door. They can hardly ring the bell, for the electricity, as usual, is off. The American ambassador is about to come back, and Baron Samedi will surely pay a little tribute in return. It happens like that all over the world. A few communists can always be found, like Jews and Catholics. Chiang Kai-shek, the heroic defender of Formosa, fed us, you remember, into the boilers of railway engines. God knows for what medical research Papa Doc may find me useful. I only ask you to remember Cécigro Nick. Do you remember that evening when Mrs. Smith accused me of being a Marxist? Accused is too strong a word. She is a kind woman who hates injustice. Yet I have grown to dislike the word Marxist. It is used so often to describe only a particular economic plan. I believe, of course, in that economic plan, in certain cases and in certain times, here in Haiti, in Cuba, in Vietnam, in India. But communism, my friend, is more than Marxism, just as Catholicism, remember I was born a Catholic too, is more than the Roman Curia. There is a mystique as well as a politique. We are humanists, you and I. You won't admit it, perhaps, but you are the son of your mother, and you once took that dangerous journey which we all have to take before the end. Catholics and communists have committed great crimes, but at least they have not stood aside, like an established society, and been indifferent. I would rather have blood on my hands than water, like Pilate. I know you and love you well, and I am writing this letter with some care, because it may be the last chance I have of communicating with you. It may never reach you, but I am sending it by what I believe to be a safe hand. Though there is no guarantee of that in the wild world we live in now. I do not mean my poor, insignificant little Haiti. I implore you, a knock on the door may not allow me to finish this sentence, so take it as the last request of a dying man. If you have abandoned one faith, do not abandon all faith. There is always an alternative to the faith we lose. Or is it the same faith under another mask? I remember Martha saying, "You are a prêtre manqué." How strangely one must appear to other people. I had left involvement behind me, I was certain, in the College of the Visitation. I had dropped it like the roulette token in the offertory. I had felt myself not merely incapable of love, many are incapable of that, but even of guilt. There were no heights and no abysses in my world. I saw myself on a great plain, walking and walking on the interminable flats. Once I might have taken a different direction, but it was too late now. When I was a boy, the fathers of the Visitation had told me that one test of a belief was this, that a man was ready to die for it. So Dr. Maggio thought too, but for what belief did Jones die? Perhaps under the circumstances it was only natural that I dreamt of Jones. He lay among the dry rocks on the flat plain beside me, and he said, "Don't ask me to find water, I can't. I'm tired, Brown, tired. After the 700th performance, I sometimes dry up on my lines, and I've only 2 lines. I said to him, "Why are you dying, Jones?" "It's in my part, old man, it's in my part. But I've got this comic line. You should hear the whole theatre laugh when I say it. The ladies in particular." "What is it?" "That's the trouble. I've forgotten it." "Jones, you must remember." "I've got it now. I have to say, just look at these bloody rocks. This is a good place, and everyone laughs till the tears come.
Then you say, to hold the bastards up, and I reply, I didn't mean that.
The ringing of the telephone woke me. I had overslept. The call came, so far as I could make out, from Mr. Fernandez, who was summoning me to my first assignment.
This concludes the reading of The Comedians by Graham Greene. Copyright 1965 and 1966 by Graham Greene. This unabridged recording of the reading of The Comedians was published by arrangement with Francis Greene and was produced in 1993 by Blackstone Audiobooks, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Books. This book was read by Joseph Porter.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.